You're listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks, your source for centered and focused play therapy coaching.
All right. Hello, everyone. I am so excited to be with you all. I know we have a lot more registered that are probably going to be hopping on, but welcome to those of you that are here right at 2. I'm really excited to have this live event. This is our first time. So really looking forward to that. And I'm really excited for you to be here. Thank you for registering. And I just realized I need to share my screen. There you go. So thank you for being a part of this. I'm going to set some expectations, go through some process and housekeeping stuff. Then we will dive into the podcast and then we will open it up for Q&A. So first, let me say there are almost 150 people registered for this event. So as we get more and more and more people in the call, it's going to be important that we all keep our mutes on, please. So if you can just make sure that your mute is on, unless you're asking a question, that would be really helpful. And we are going to take advantage of this opportunity. I ask for your grace and your patience. This is the first one we've ever done, and I've never had this many people that are going to be on a call before. So if we have some hiccups or some tech issues, or we're just not really solidified on our process, it's just because it's new. But I do want to actually share a couple of forecasting thoughts with you. The overwhelming response to this live event has just absolutely surprised me in the best way. And that leads me to believe that this is something that we need to do more often. So I want you to be aware that we are going to likely schedule these probably at least quarterly, maybe even monthly moving forward. And let me share a little bit of my heart. I want you to understand kind of where this came from and the origins of this whole live event. The first piece of this was when I did the meetup in Atlanta at the conference. And it was so amazing for me to put faces and names with listeners. And it was the connection and the relationships and the interaction that meant so much, because I know you all feel like you know me very well because you listen to me all the time. I feel like I know you from a distance, but I would like to have a more personal connection. So that's one of the reasons why we did this. We kind of brainstormed, how can we connect with more podcast listeners? And the live event was kind of birthed out of that. But here's a much more, I think, real and relevant reason as well. So many of you reach out to me and tell me that you feel lonely. So many of you reach out and say you feel very alone doing CCPT. You feel unsupported. You feel misunderstood. You don't have the tribe that you wish that you did. And I want these events to help you feel that you are not alone. And there are tons and tons of CCPTs that are like-minded and that are in the exact same level of passion and desire and commitment to the model as you. So that's kind of where this is all heading. And I look forward to many more of these events. The thing that I love the most about podcasting is the intimate connection with you all. I really, truly feel every episode that I am talking to you directly, and now I get to actually have faces and names associated with you all as listeners. So really grateful for you and super glad that you're here. So let's dive into Q&A. I know some of you have been putting questions in. I know some of you have been sharing where you are. Maya and Eric will kind of be communicating with me through my phone. So if I'm staring down at my phone, that's why I'm getting messages from them. So let's see. The first one is from Kimberly H.
Sure. Hi. I am a school-based therapist in a middle school, so ages 11 to 14. I've got a fully equipped playroom and practice CCPT. Most of my clients engage through play, but each year I've had a handful that only talk. I still am CCPT. That's my mindset. Use those reflective responses. But I'm curious if I can ethically say that the therapeutic modality in a treatment note is CCPT, since from the client's end, they are only talking, they're not engaging in play, even though my response to them is CCPT.
Ah, okay, helpful. So I mean, the short answer is yes. And the reason why the answer is yes is when we document, it is from a clinical and theoretical perspective. So if you are not deviating, and let me, for the rest of you all, let me make sure this is known. When we work with 12 to 14, that is actually still considered CCPT age appropriate, but often the client modifies it themselves. So they move more toward activity-based and more toward conversation. So that is a natural progression. 12 to 14, they tend to be more verbal and they tend to move away from playing and more into activities. So they will throw a ball against the wall while they talk, or they'll play Uno while they talk. So it's not so playful as it is just gives them something to do so that they can be a little bit more conversational. That is still within the age range of CCPT with the modifications. And as long as you are still adherent to the model, you would still want to be clear that that is the clinical approach that you're using. It doesn't matter because, look, it's predicated on the child is in charge. The child knows what they need. So if a 14-year-old comes in and chooses to play, or if a 14 comes in and chooses to talk, it's still CCPT. You're just following the child's lead and honoring the fact that they know what they need to do and how they need to do it. Thanks for the question, Kimberly. Okay, let me see. Let's see who's next in here. We've got Brooke M.
Hi, my name's Brooke. I currently work in a group office, and I specialize in trauma of all ages, but I'm only CCPT with my littles. And my question has to do with how we address ongoing parentification of our clients during those parent check-ins and with the parents, specifically those who are parentifying their children due to external strenuous circumstances like isolation or chronic illness.
Okay. Hi, Brooke, by the way. So I think in that scenario, one of the things that we're always trying to do when we meet with parents is psychoeducation and equipping them with what they need to know, even if they don't know that they need to know it. So here's what I mean by that. Often the goal of the consultation is to provide perspective, to provide objectivity, and then equip them with different approaches or some insight, some awareness that they didn't have before, and always clearly tied to CCPT principles. So I think that a lot of that is about normalizing. You know, it makes sense that you are in this situation. I mean, a lot of what we do is validation. We reflectively respond to parents just like we do to kids. So when we meet with parents, often it's validating and it's seeming understanding and kind of helping them feel that we get it. Yet at the same time, our number one goal always is advocate for the child. And it's really unhealthy for a child to be parentified. We can speak to the clinical aspects of that. We can speak to the long-term aspects of that. And often when we do so, we need to say things like, and we know that when kids are put in positions like this, when we know that the familial dynamic creates this kind of relationship, we know that. And when we say that, it's not, I'm telling you this, it's we have this as knowledge as a field. So that's usually a really helpful intro into bringing up stuff like that. We know that research shows, data indicates those kinds of comments, but it's really kind of helping them understand there are alternatives. So while I understand why you're in the situation that you're in, it would be helpful if you, and then you provide the psychoeducation to help them transition away from the patterns of behavior that they've been in and toward more healthy and appropriate tied to CCPT. And you can always frame it that way. The more that you can use the skills that the child is getting in the playroom, the more impact that we have therapeutically. So if you can start doing XYZ, this will be so much more helpful. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. I think specifically, if there could be a little bit more clarification on how to meet those skills that like situationally are really struggling to be met. You know, I have a lot of parents where they might be willing one-on-one, but they just really, they find themselves unable to sort of meet those needs. And I think that's where I kind of struggle with meeting that in those consults.
So I'm wondering if it's that complex of a case, if it wouldn't make sense to transition them to CPRT, because that gives parents much more buy-in, much more ownership. It becomes a whole different way of interacting at home versus every five weeks, I try to equip you with something and then it's really difficult for them to implement it. It's a much more structured, formulaic type of intervention. And so sometimes we have transitioned out of CCPT into CPRT when the family dynamic and situation warrants it.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah, that's really helpful because I tried to transition into filial and that was the barrier I kept running into. And so I think that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, okay. I'm glad. All right, Tess K, what's your question?
I was curious to know your thoughts about clients continuing CCPT once they have met their goals. If, you know, parents have expressed that they're still gaining value from it and the kiddo is still engaging and wants to keep coming.
I call those marinators. And you will always have those families. No joke, Maya is on the call. She will confirm. I had a family, I've already been working with them for, gosh, I think 4 years maybe. And she walked in the office a couple of weeks ago and said to Maya, yeah, we're gonna be coming here until he gets married or he graduates high school. I don't remember what the time frame was, but it was like way too long. I was like, no, you're not. Anyway, so here's my thought on it. We want to be ethical and we want to make sure that this isn't a, I'm stringing you along because you'll just stay in therapy forever. There has to be a point where we say there's just not a clinical justification for the child to continue. So we will reduce frequency over time to kind of wean off in those scenarios because parents look at it as a crutch sometimes. Kids look at it as a crutch sometimes. I mean, it becomes a security blanket and it's safe and it's warm and it's cozy and you're a part of our family and we love you so much. But unfortunately, what that does is it blocks a spot for a kid that really needs to start therapy, first and foremost. And second of all, they both have to, parents and kids have to get to a point where they realize they're the ones that made the changes and they can continue to operate without you. You are not the hinge pin for their success. They are, and they have to come to that conclusion. And often that is forced by termination. So what we typically do is we reduce to biweekly, then we reduce to monthly. And then if they're really, really wanting to hang on, we say, you know what? It's an open door. Just reach out if you want to come in for a session. And it becomes an as-needed check-in rather than a scheduled appointment. And then they still feel like they have that lifeline if they need or want it. But it's not a consistent appointment. And therefore, the child and the parents both acquiesce to the idea that, okay, I don't really need this. It's just something that I've been clinging to for a really long time. So the weaning off process is helpful. And then going on that as needed basis is a couple of families kind of like, okay, I'll agree to that, but I won't just quit cold turkey. And if they reach out once every 2 or 3 months, you just get them in and it's no big deal. And it's still a check-in for a child. I mean, we call them booster sessions. A lot of times kids benefit from the reminder of everything that they've learned and gained in play. So when they come in every 2-3 months, it's a positive thing for them, but it is just kind of as needed rather than consistent at that point. Okay. How about Beth R?
Hey, Brenna. Okay. My question is, I'm in Texas, so I'm an LPC. My long-term goal is to open up a group practice that is strictly for kids, strictly CCPT. And so right now I am not pursuing my RPT. I'm just wondering, you know, you're talking about impact. How important would that be to pursue? If that's my eventual goal, I know.
Oh gosh.
Sorry.
Okay. So, all right. I'm treading lightly.
Okay.
I am an RPT. I think there is huge value in making it known and clear that you have the appropriate level of training and supervision and education to do something that you're professing to do. And I would say that's true across all industries. You know, if you are credentialed, if you have letters after your name, it means that you have been trained. So I'm very much in favor of a world in which we know you are more highly trained than someone that took a 2-hour online training course and calls themselves something. So with that said, I'm going to pivot a little bit and let's talk about clinical impact. The only thing parents care about is whether or not you can help their kids. It's all they care about. They don't care if you're licensed. They don't care if your master's prepared, if you have a PhD. They don't care if you have 8 hours of training or 8,000 hours of training. They don't care what acronyms are after your name. They don't care about RPT. In Florida, RPT doesn't even mean registered play therapist. So really, I have RPT after my name and people think I'm a physical therapist because Florida's proprietary RPT is physical therapy. No one cares. No one has ever once asked me if I'm licensed. No one's ever asked me what my degree is in. No one's ever asked me what RPT stands for. Nobody cares. Why? Because all they care about is if you can help them. So while I value credentialing, I think if we want impact, the impact that we have is we're at the top of our field. We know our stuff. We're fully adherent. We specialize exclusively in CCPT. And we provide hope and transformation that parents are asking for. And that's all that matters. If you have a burning desire to have RPT after your name, go for it. I don't think it serves any professional purpose in the sense of the impact that you'll have with children and families. I think it serves a clinical purpose because there's a distinction that you have. But in the way of impacting your community, I don't think it has the weight that you would worry about it.
Okay. Is that, yes, I understand. And I agree with you 100% on impact on families and kids. What about as a business owner? So having a group practice that is CCPT.
If you know your stuff and you can supervise your clinicians and you make them adhere to the model and you make sure that everyone is trained exactly the same way and executes exactly the same way, it doesn't matter what letters are after your name.
Okay, that is super helpful. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right, Mally M.
I'm a master's clinical mental health counseling student, and I am about to start my internship with a public school district. And I recently found out that I'm only going to be seeing kids ages 11 and up. And you actually already touched on this with the first question, but I was just wanted to hear your thoughts on how CCPT tenets and principles can apply to older kids and teens.
Sure. All right. So sweet spot is 3 to 12, but it works up to 14. So 11 to 14, you're kind of in that they're developing abstract reasoning. They're getting a little bit away from all of the emotional. They have a little bit of cognitive function at that point. They're a little bit more conversational. There's all kinds of shifts that are taking place. So really what you need to do is you make sure that you have older child options in your playroom. So you want to have games that are well suited for older kids. You want to have card game options. Would you rather game is a really big hit with teens. Thumb balls, really big hit with teens. Bop it, any kind of like challenging, you know, like the mazes that are in the sphere and like you have to follow the ball down the track, whatever, like anything that challenges older kids. And really, the beauty of what we do is we know from research that as long as a child's hands are engaged, actually a human, doesn't matter what age, as long as a human being's hands are engaged in doing something, their inhibitions are lessened and they're more comfortable talking. So you could just have a thing of Play-Doh or slime, and as long as they can just do something with their hands, they will feel more comfortable than just sitting and, quote, talking to somebody. So activity-based is the shift. Make sure you have things that are appropriate for older kids. Choices jars are really helpful. Like I said, the thumb balls. Older kids like active toys as well. So they will shoot a Nerf gun at a dart. No, they will shoot a dart at a target. I don't know what I just said. They will try to do any kind of self-challenging type of play, like get the Velcro on the thing. They'll do bow and arrows. So active play is usually pretty well suited for older kids as well. But be mindful that they're going to do a hybrid of talking and activity. And that's just the natural progression of working with older kids.
Definitely. Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure. All right, Julia H.
Hi, Dr. Brenna. My question was, so I am transitioning from being like a traveling CCPT to being in a position where I'll have an office. And I was just wondering what your suggestions would be for, you know, organizing, toys, toy selection. I have like a basic kit, but, kind of building that up. And then part two of the question is also, I'm kind of trying to think through any common limit setting scenarios so I can be prepared and not just have to kind of fly off the handle with that. So are any differences you can think of from being in the field to being in an office-based scenario when it comes to ACT?
Okay. Well, that let me start with that one because that's an easier one. You will actually find it far less necessary to set limits in an office. It is so much easier to regulate the environment, to control the environment. They can't run off and do random things. You're in a closed location. There's not interruptions. There's not pets and people. And it's so much easier to not set limits when you're in an office. So I actually think you'll find you don't set nearly as many. And really, we go back to, I have to be safe, you have to be safe, the toys can't be broken on purpose. If none of those scenarios are happening, you don't even need to set limits. So your standards are going to be the child's in danger, they're doing something that could hurt themselves or you, or they're purposely doing damage in the playroom. That really only happens here and there. So, I mean, there are weeks that go by that I don't set one limit at my office. So I think you'll find that far easier when you're not traveling anymore. As far as setting it up, I think you need to look at the layout of the standard CCPT room. So you want all your acting out aggressive toys together. You want all your real life toys together. You want all of your creative artistic toys together. And then you want to make sure that there's a rug in the center to indicate the play boundary. And then the rest of it, you just kind of, you know, fill in as you go. However, here's my number one tip. Your playroom needs to be neutral. In other words, don't personalize it for your taste. Don't put all kinds of artwork on the wall. Don't put sayings up that are like really friendly and happy about kids. It's supposed to be any kid can come in and make it their own. So when play therapists get all excited about, quote, decorating their playroom, it actually undermines the neutrality of the room, which is any kid can come in and it feels like it's a fit for them. And if you have bright polka dots on the wall, some kids might hate that. So we just have to be careful. We set up the toys and we organize the playroom for the clinical aspect of it, but the walls and everything else are meant to be very plain so that it's CCPT appropriate.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. All right. So I want to... really quickly, before we move on to the next question, I want to give you the rundown that Maya informed me of here. So listen to this, y'all. On this call, we have Netherlands, Trinidad, Scotland, lots of places in the UK, Australia, Ireland, Alabama, New York, Georgia, Maryland, Colorado, Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, Utah, Tennessee, California, Ohio, Texas, Washington, Virginia. So exciting. I love y'all. Okay. It looks like Brooke and Kimberly both had two questions. So Kimberly H., if you want to share your second question, I can address that.
Sure, thanks. So you mentioned an episode a while ago talking about diagnoses that you've sometimes used the diagnosis deferred code if there's, like, I think it was a parent had to submit to insurance. Could you just speak a little bit more about that? I work for a school program, so it's out of my hands that we do have to do a diagnosis. We do seek reimbursement from Medicaid. Just some ideas or approaches of how to raise the question of, hey, this might be an option. I imagine pushback would be, oh, Medicaid won't accept that. Legally or ethically, we need to make sure there's medical justification, as well as just that this is how it's always done. So it's always going to be this way. So just a little bit more about that.
Sure. So I have only ever in 20 years, come next month, February 16th, by the way, come next month, I am 20 years in, and I have only ever done diagnosis deferred my entire career. I have never had any issue with it being a valid code. Now, insurance companies will push back on it because they don't like people that work around their system. And a super bill and a diagnosis deferred is a workaround, and they push back, of course. But Medicaid will accept it. Insurances will accept it. And essentially what you're saying is, I'm not making a diagnosis at this time. So you're not saying there are no issues. You're not saying we're doing nothing and there's no reason for us to even be in therapy. That's not the implication. The implication is I'm not making a diagnosis at this time. And so that's why we use it. That's why it's a valid deferred code. And let me see what else you had, other components of that. So yeah, you get pushback, but it's not because they won't accept the code. Yes, parents do not want a diagnosis. So that's actually one of the reasons we use that. And that's one of the justifications that we give, is if we go through standard insurance process, we are required to diagnose, and that's on a permanent mental health record for a child. And many parents do not want that. Now, the parents that are seeking diagnoses, they're more than welcome to go get one somewhere else, but it's not going to come from me. So I make it very clear from the get-go, I do not diagnose. I mean, I'm legally able to, but I do not diagnose. And if you need to pursue evaluation or assessment, that's something that, you know, you can absolutely do, but that's not going to come from us. So I think that that is just kind of the standard part of our process. And yes, that is very much. Okay. So I've made a career. I talk about this all the time on the coaching program. I've made a career of looking at what everyone does in the industry and what the standard operating procedure is. And I go, but why? And then I do something else because I think it's better practice. So just because it's common doesn't mean that it's best practice. And I'm just very, very purposeful about looking at things and going, this does not make sense to me. Why would we do this? There are alternatives. This seems better. And then I go in that direction. So I think that it's important for us to challenge the notion of, look, it's always done this way, so there's an expectation that it will be. I think it's actually our advocacy coming in to say, this kid is 3 years old. Why in the world would I diagnose this kid at three and have that follow him the rest of his life when we can address this in therapy and he won't even be anxious anymore? So that's my rationale. I always share that with parents, and 99 out of 100 parents are appreciative that that is our take on giving a diagnosis deferred. Okay. Let me see. Brooke M, you have another question as well.
Yeah. So my second question was about how CCPT helps with children whose behavioral struggles come from a need for attention due to attachment issues. So, you know, I know that CCPT works and I stay adherent, but I think as far as more understanding and being able to communicate, you know, if CCPT allows the child to play through, you know, whatever they need to regulate their emotions. I guess I'm not so confident on how to communicate how that happens when the child isn't showing those same behaviors during sessions, because there is that one-on-one attention and attunement. And so they're being sort of soothed by that and not able to sort of practice regulating when that's not available.
Sure. So that's actually a multi-layered question. So I'll do my best to unpack it. I think first and foremost, we understand that CCPT works because of the relationship and the environment, right? It's a unique environment and it's a unique relationship. Self-actualization, the core conditions, Rogers' tenets of these are the things required for us to self-actualize. So it doesn't really matter that it's isolated to the playroom. There will inevitably be carryover as the child self-actualizes. So that is like an irreversible process. As the child becomes a better version of themselves, it spills into all of these other arenas and environments and relationships, et cetera. So it's predicated on self-actualization takes place. However, I agree with you that in that controlled environment, it is easy for a child sometimes to make gains and make changes and experience that. And then when they're thrust into other scenarios, it is harder. But playroom is the practice ground. So as the child is learning this, building the skills, feeling capable, testing what it feels like, look, trying out new skills is exhausting. And kids cannot sustain that when they don't have the scenario that makes it easiest for them to do it. So they're going to practice with you. It will eventually go into all of the other arenas of their life, but they have to feel equipped and ready and prepared for the, okay, now I'm going to try it at home. Now I'm going to try it in this relationship. Now I'm going to try it here. So I think explaining that is usually very helpful, that it's a practice ground where nothing matters, so that when it does matter, they feel more equipped and confident. And then I think the big picture of the whole thing is when it's this attachment, especially, the relationship is so important with all of the other people in that child's life. And that's where the advocacy comes in and the psychoeducation for other adults, because we can't ever expect, this is my, I'm glad I'm actually live because I do this when I podcast and you never see it. So kid starts here and parent starts here. Kid makes all this progress, all this work, does all of this stuff in therapy. There's only ever going to be a midline where the child can get to. If adults, caregivers, other stakeholders never move and they just want, quote, the child to get better, well, there's still this gap. So what we always want is parents actually do their work and parents put in the time and the energy and the effort and they make changes. Now, the client is the change agent in the family, unequivocally. It's the legal scales of justice, right? So when the child starts to make changes and adds a pebble or takes a pebble away, it naturally forces the other side to change too. So there is an element of change begets change. Yet we have this sense of kids going to move. And if the other person in the child's life doesn't move, doesn't budge, there's always going to be a gap. So especially for attachment related stuff, the kid needs the other people in their world to put in the time and the investment into the relationship and into healing as well. So that's where you advocate for that in the parent consults, and you really stress how important it is that they're making changes as well. Is that helpful?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I think I've got maybe, oh, okay. Terry, you have a question.
Hello. Nice to see you.
You too.
My question, I forgot now, I have a few, but I'll only ask the one because I only asked for one. So when a child is doing role play and you're not invited into the role play, but they're playing out a couple of characters which you know are meaningful, like I'm going to use an example, say they're playing out the mother and the child and maybe a sibling, and they're playing all those roles, which one are you going to focus on? Or are you going to focus on, it's quite hard, obviously, when it's a natural narrative and it's going quite fast, which one are you going to reflect? Or don't you reflect any of them? Or do you reflect the whole content when it's finished?
You actually are going to transition to reflective responses in the third person. So as the child is saying, like, you know, or not even saying anything, sometimes they're just acting it out. So like the mom, but if you know who the characters are, right? If the child has made it clear, okay. So then in that case, you're going to just refer to all of your responses in the third person. So if the child was actually doing it, you would say you, right? Like you're excited. You went over there. You did this. Now that it's role play, you transition to third person. Oh, the mom went over there and the sister's angry. And the dad said this. And you're still track behavior, reflect content, reflect feelings, but it shifts to third person because now you're acknowledging who each person is in the play. And then if ever the child takes ownership again, then you transition back to first person and then it just becomes you.
Right. Okay. So if you don't know who the characters are, which with somebody else, it could be that you don't know. You know that there's a parent child, but you don't know.
Then you say that one or they.
Right.
Like, oh, that one got really upset or they went over there. So it's still neutral, but you make it known that you're following exactly what's transpiring in the narrative.
Perfect. Can I ask one more while I have you?
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you. So I was listening to your recent podcast there with regard to children that use self-depreciating language about themselves. It was only the other day, I think. And you had said that the child, the underlying reason behind that was low self-esteem. And the child was was talking about something that they were doing or that they couldn't do in the moment. Maybe they were failing at something. I was wondering if you had a child that used self-depreciating statements and looking at you and almost to get your attention rather than, oh, I'm not good at this, looking at you, or I know this isn't going to work out, looking at you. So it's less about the thing they're doing and more about, will you tell me I am good? Will you give me some feedback? So it's a kind of a bit of a different reason for self-depreciating. And I was wondering if your response is different because of that, if that's what you're picking up.
Well, so I would actually argue that it is still rooted in the same issue.
Yes.
So they're validation seeking, they're attention seeking, they're, I need you to tell me that I'm good. I need you to tell me that I'm capable. So really what that tells me is they've probably been overpraised and their internal locus of control is non-existent. So in other words, they learn that I only have value and I only have worth and I'm only good at something if someone tells me that I have it or that I am. So now they're in this conditioned pattern of waiting to be validated, waiting to be praised, waiting to be acknowledged. So it actually is still rooted in no sense of identity and self-worth.
Yes.
And they've been overpraised. So the antidote is obviously encouragement in the playroom always. So we, with that kind of kid, we over-esteem build, we over-encourage as much as possible. And then the second piece of, do we respond differently? No. You might acknowledge that the child is seeking a reaction. Like, seems like you're looking at me to see what I think. So you might acknowledge that the child is doing it, but you don't give in to that because all that does is reinforce the nature of, I only think that I'm good if someone tells me that I am.
Okay. Gotcha. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so I know we're out of time. If you all are able and willing to stay on, I can keep answering questions. A few more have come in. If you need to hop off, I completely understand. Above all, thank you so much for being here. We're going to do more of these. I'm really looking forward to this. You all mean a lot to me, and I'm really grateful. Okay, I think we did it, y'all. And it was only an hour and 25 minutes, so that was better than I thought. All right. Thank you all so much for being here. Eric has given you the link for the presentation. So if you would like to watch that, please do. I think it will open your mind to a lot of stuff related to impact even. So I'm really, really appreciative. We will do this again. So tell your friends, get your colleagues to sign up next time. We'll do this again soon. And I'm super grateful for you all. Have a wonderful weekend. And thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to the Play Therapy Podcast with Dr. Brenna Hicks. For more episodes and resources, please go to www.playtherapypodcast.com.